Well, welcome to the second quarter of Bible Stories for Adults, the second quarter of Old Testament. For the last 3 months, we've been looking at the stories in the book of Genesis. And as you see, we've had to zoom through a bunch of them. But in order to cover the whole Bible in 3 years, you have to do some of that. Today, we now jump into the book of Exodus. For the next quarter, we're going to see this new nation of Israel and look at their stories until they have become a nation with a king in their own land. So we'll be covering stories from Exodus through 1 Samuel. So strap on and we'll get going. Now, if you remember last week when we talked about Genesis and the week before when we concluded our stories on Genesis, what was the status of the Israelites, of the descendants of Israel, the descendants of Jacob? They were in Egypt. They had gone down to Egypt to escape the famine. Joseph had seen that his role in what had happened, God had used that to be able to bring the family down to Egypt so that they could live through this famine. But it had a much bigger, God had a much bigger plan. God had a bigger plan to bring his people down for a time of preparation. We see that in Genesis chapter 46 verses 1 through 4. And this is when Jacob was heading down to Egypt on his way, and God wanted to make sure that he knew he was doing the right thing, that he was following God's lead, that God's promises still stood, and that God would be with him wherever he went. Just because he was leaving Canaan, where he had experienced time with God, that he would not be leaving God. God would be with him even in Egypt. So God tells him, talks to him in Genesis 46. It says, "So Israel, that is Jacob, set out with all that was his, and when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, 'Jacob, Jacob.' 'Here I am,' he replied. 'I am God, the God of your father,' he said. 'Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes.'" So God, in assuring Jacob that he was following God's plan, he told him, "I've got plans for you down there. I'm bringing you down there not just to get away from this famine, but I'm going to turn you into a great nation. And then I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring your people back, your descendants back. And while you're down in Egypt, I will be with you. You're not leaving my presence." Now they go to Egypt, and this group of people, ever since God called Abram, he called Abram and his descendants to be a separate, a cut off, a circumcised people, separated and cut off from other people, to be a chosen people of God. Well, they're going to a foreign land, and we'll see that they're going to be there for quite some time. So how does God make sure that they remain a separate people and don't get intermixed with the other people that are there? It's too easy, especially given the amount of time that they're going to be there, too easy for them to get assimilated into that nation and intermix with the people. Genesis 46, a little bit later on, in verses 31 to 34, "Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, 'I'll go up and speak to Pharaoh, and I'll say to him, my brothers and my father's household, who were living in the land of Canaan, have come to me. The men are shepherds, they tend livestock, and they brought along their flocks and herds and everything they own. Now when Pharaoh calls you in and asks, what's your occupation? You should answer, your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our fathers did. Well then, you'll be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, for all shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians." So we see that they were allowed to settle in Goshen. Goshen is it's a very fertile region in the Nile Delta. On the eastern side, when you're coming around the Mediterranean Sea from Canaan, Goshen is the first area where you come to, the first part that the first part of Egypt the travelers come into. For some reason, this was not very settled, and so there was land available, and so this would be a place where they would be able to settle away from the Egyptians. We also see that Tanis, which was the capital of Egypt at the time, was located on the western side of Goshen, so they wouldn't be far away from Joseph either. So all of that kind of fit together. If you look at the The next chapter, chapter 27 or 47, verses 5 and 6, you see a little bit of information about Goshen. It says, Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you, and the whole land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best part of the land. Let them live in Goshen. And if you know of any among them with special ability, put them in charge of my livestock. So they, where they were able to settle was in Goshen, which was a very lush, the best part of the land, very green. You would imagine that, you would expect that from a the big river delta region, like the Nile Delta. And so they were able to settle in the best part of the land. We see that they were able to be kept separate because they went to an area that wasn't populated by Egyptians. Plus, on top of them wanting to remain separate from the Egyptians and other peoples, because God commanded it, the Egyptians found, the Hebrews found Semites detestable to them and shepherds detestable to them. So by their occupation, that made them detestable to the Egyptians. So the Egyptians did not want to mix with them. So those things together helped keep them a separate people and keep them from intermixing with the others. Now that last verse that we looked at, Pharaoh had said, hey, by the way, if any of your brothers are extra good at keeping livestock, let them take care of mine. Well, why did Pharaoh offer that? Why did Pharaoh need someone to take care of his livestock? He already had people taking care of his livestock, right? Well, if you remember in the story in chapter 47, when Joseph is distributing the food, we'll start in verse 13. There was no food, however, in the whole region because the famine was severe. Both Egypt and Canaan wasted away because of the famine. Joseph collected all the money that was to be found in Egypt and Canaan in payment for the grain they were buying, and he brought it to Pharaoh's palace. Well, when the money was all gone, the people of Egypt and Canaan, all of Egypt came to Joseph and said, give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? Our money is used up. Well, then bring your livestock, said Joseph. I will sell you food in exchange for your livestock since your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and he gave them food in exchange for their horses, their sheep, their goats, their cattle, their donkeys. And he brought them through that year with food in exchange for all their livestock. And then it goes on to say that when they ran out of livestock, they then sold their land over and turned their land over to Pharaoh in exchange for food. And then they turned themselves over as slaves, as servants to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh had become very wealthy. Pharaoh all of a sudden had all this livestock and didn't have the infrastructure to take care of them. And so that's why he needed some helpers. And so everything happened at an opportune time for the land of Goshen was a good place to raise animals because it was green, good for cattle, good for sheep. And so Jacob's sons were put in charge of a lot of Pharaoh's livestock there. On top of that, we see that they came to Egypt during this time of famine, and Egypt had a famine, Canaan had a famine, but these guys had an inside track. Verse 12 of chapter 47, Joseph also provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to the number of their children. So they had an inside track. They knew the guy who was in charge of distributing the food, and Joseph took care of them. They didn't have to worry about buying the food, so they were able to prosper, and Joseph took care of them. So that's where we're left at the end of the book of Genesis. Okay? The Israelites, now again, what are Israelites? Well, we have the covenant blessing going to Abraham and his descendants, so the Abrahamites, and then that was passed to his son Isaac and his descendants, so the offshoots, the Ishmaelites and other sons of Abraham were not part of that covenant choosing, only the Isaacites. Okay? And then from Isaac that was passed on to Jacob, not the Esau people, the Esauites, or we call them Edomites is what they became known as, but instead to the Jacobites. Now Jacob, his name was changed by God when he wrestled with the angel overnight, and his name was changed to he struggles with God, or Israel. And so we call the descendants of Jacob, instead of calling them Jacobites, we call them Israelites. So the Israelites, all those who descended from Jacob, were part of this covenant family. you've got the 12 tribes. His 12 sons constituted the 12 tribes that that followed from them. And all of them moved to Egypt, and they were all settled in the land of Goshen. And so they're down there. Things are well. They're taken care of. It's during a time of famine, but they've got food to eat. They've got jobs. They're working for Pharaoh, taking care of his animals. And they're with Joseph. They're with each other. Everything is going well. And so then we move to Exodus. Now, you don't see this in the English Bible, but in the Hebrew Bible, the very first word of the book of Exodus is the word "and." Okay, "and." Why? What does that tell you? Well, that tells you it's a continuation of the story that we have in Genesis. We're not ending one book, Genesis, and starting a whole new, different story. This is a continuation. It's not a sequel. It's just what happened next. Okay. Now, there is a time gap in there. We've got 430 years between when Genesis closes out and Exodus begins. So we've got a time gap there, or close to 400 years. But it's still part of the story. And Exodus picks up where Genesis left off. In fact, it comes back and it tells you a little bit about what was going on. We'll just start in verses 1 through 5 here. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Those are the first four. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, what we've just been told here is nothing different than what we already know, that we were told at the end of the book of Genesis. So when Jacob and his sons there in chapter 46, that 70 of them came down. So we've got that restated. We see then that the purpose we saw before, that in Genesis 46, 1-4, why God sent them to Egypt was he was going to turn them into a great nation. And that's where Exodus picks up. Very next verses, 6-7, it says, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly, and the land became, and they became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them." All right, that last verse, what part of that don't you get? It says the same thing four times, okay? It says that the Israelites became fruitful, they multiplied greatly, they became exceedingly numerous. The land was filled with them. Okay? What's the point? Well, you say the same thing four times. They were very prolific and had lots and lots of kids and multiplied greatly, filled the land, were becoming a great nation, just as God had said. We see then in Exodus 12 that when they leave, verses 37-38, "The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600, this is them leaving in the Exodus, 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds." So you see that 600,000 men, that doesn't count the women and children. So you figure there's probably a couple million of them. Plus, it says others went with them as well, who weren't Jews, who weren't Israelites. So we see in this 400 years, they expanded greatly from 70 to a couple million or even more. They came down because Joseph, their brother, had been put in charge of all of Egypt. Pharaoh gave a tremendous amount of power to Joseph. He said, "Joseph, everything is under you. Everybody reports to you. You're above everybody except for me." That's it. He gave Joseph his signet ring. That gave his seal, that whenever Joseph said anything or put his approval on something, that was just as if Pharaoh was saying or approving of it. So he gave him a tremendous amount of power, and that's very surprising considering that Joseph was what? He had been a prisoner. He got him out of jail. Before that, he was a slave. And on top of that, he was a Hebrew. Remember in Genesis 43, verse 32, this is when Joseph's brothers came to him, and it says they served him that is Joseph by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that's detestable to Egyptians. So Joseph appeared to be an Egyptian to his brothers at this time, so they couldn't eat with him. But Joseph was a Hebrew, and he was not an Egyptian, so he couldn't eat with the other Egyptians, so he kind of ate alone. And despite the fact that Hebrews were detestable to Egyptians, that they couldn't even share the same table together, Pharaoh had given so much power to Joseph. Now, if you look at Egyptian history and try to place these stories in Egyptian history, it sheds a little bit of light on why that might have even been possible. Part of the trouble we have is that we don't know for sure when all this happened. The stories that we have at the end of Genesis and in Exodus do not tell us who was Pharaoh at any of those times. It gives us some signs, but it doesn't tell us for sure. And basically, scholars who have studied this have narrowed it down to a couple of different options. And you see those on page 2 at the bottom of the first section under A New King. And two options. One would be that the Exodus occurred around 1290 B.C., and that would have put Joseph in Egypt somewhere around 1670 B.C., sometime in that range. You could also make a good case for the Exodus occurring in 1466 B.C., which would have put Joseph in Egypt around 1900 B.C. And you can make good cases for either one of those. They're both good, valid descriptions. And that's what scholars, they've pretty well narrowed it down to one of those two times. I'll just kind of look kind of at one of them, at the case where the Exodus would be around 1290 B.C. and Joseph around 1670. If you look back in history in Egypt, in 1730 B.C., Egypt was invaded by a group of Semites. Now, Semites were who? They were descendants of Shem. Okay, Shem was one of the two, or one of the three sons of Noah. You had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Egyptians, by the way, were descendants of Ham. Now, Semites, not only were the Israelite Semites descendants of Shem, but also all the Canaanites, all the people around Canaan that the Israelites were dealing with, were living around, as well as that we'll be seeing as we keep talking about the stories, they were all Semites. And so a group of Semites came and attacked Egypt in 1730 B.C. and conquered Egypt and began ruling. So the pharaohs of Egypt were not Egyptian. They were Semites. They ruled there in northern Egypt, there in the Nile Delta area. Now, there was a group of Egyptians who maintained control over themselves, and they ruled from southern Egypt, okay, down further south down the Nile River. Now, that area is actually called Upper Egypt, where the Nile Delta is called Lower Egypt. Even though it's much further north, you look on a map and you go, well, the Delta should be called Upper, but it's an elevation thing. The river flows downhill, right? So the Nile goes from an upper elevation to a lower elevation, so the upper elevation is further south, and that's where the Egyptians ruled themselves during this time of these Semite rulers. These Semite rulers were called Hyksos. They were also called shepherd kings, because they kept sheep. These Hyksos ruled the Nile Delta over to Canaan for about 150 years. So if Joseph had been around and come to Egypt in 1670 B.C., Hyksos would have been ruling then. So the pharaoh that would have put him in place would have been a fellow Semite, you know, like a Canaanite or the like, not an Egyptian. So that might be why it was okay for Joseph to have been given so much power. Possibly a guy named Apepi II of the 16th dynasty is an idea of who that person might have been. Now going on, we see that in 1570 B.C., Amos, who was a king down in the south, an Egyptian, he defended and came and attacked the Hyksos and took Egypt back from the Hyksos, took power, and recreated an Egyptian Egypt, okay? And he was the first king of the 18th dynasty, And likely you would expect at that time on, Egyptians just hated Semites because of what had happened to them during the time of the Hyksos. And could have added to suspicion that they might have had for the Israelites. In fact, we see that in Exodus 1 verse 8. It says, "Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt." Well, typically when a new king comes to power in Egypt, didn't know about Joseph, that would have been some kind of dynasty change. Okay, you would have dynasties where someone was king and then his son was king, maybe his grandson was king, but then someone else would decide they wanted to be king, and so they'd go and they'd wipe out the current rulers and they'd become king and you'd start a new dynasty. Well, the Hyksos was a dynasty, then you have Amos started this new dynasty, so this could be talking about him. Now, would he know about Joseph? Maybe he learned about Joseph in the annals. Maybe he didn't. If he did, he probably didn't care. Who cares what Joseph did back during the times of the Hyksos? It doesn't matter. And so he would have had no allegiance, no desire to support the Israelites, take care of them. For him, it was just a group. It would have been another group of Semites, another group of foreigners in his land that he really didn't want to have there. So going on, a new kingdom period in Egypt began. Egypt grew. It expanded militarily. They expanded. They even gained control of Canaan. So they grew quickly. Up in the north of Canaan, you had another great power, the Hittites. And you've heard of the Hittites. We'll run into them from time to time as we continue to go on. And the Hittites and the Egyptians were fierce enemies. And they had a big battle. The Egyptians lost a lot of control to the Hittites under Akhenaten. Akhenaten happened to be King Tut's father-in-law, okay, Tutankhamun, so you remember King Tut. As things went on under the 19th dynasty, they gained a new energy and new expansion under that, especially under Ramses, and then under Ramses II in around 1300 BC. Under Ramses II is where you really saw the glory days of Egypt. He was a great expansionist, built a lot of statues. If you had to name an Egyptian pharaoh, that's probably the name you'd pop up, because we've heard so much about Ramses and there's so much his name's on a lot of things. And so he was a great expansionist. He also battled the Hittites in Kadesh in 1288 BC. And at that time, basically both of them lost. The Egyptians and the Hittites both lost. Both of their militaries were very greatly weakened. And so the expansion kind of stopped from the Egyptians as well as from the Hittites at that time. The thought is that Ramses II was possibly the Pharaoh of the oppression. That is, when Moses grew up, when Moses was found as a baby, and he grew up in Pharaoh's household, it could have been under Ramses II. The next king that followed Ramses II was Menurptah, and he was a pretty weak king, far weaker, had a lot of troubles with invaders from Phrygia. Whereas dad had had trouble with the Hittites, the Phrygians, working against Egypt with a weaker military, came down and attacked Egypt on the Egyptians' coastline and had a big battle that cost him dearly there and lost control of Canaan for 900 years. And he's possibly the Pharaoh of the Exodus. He had lots of other problems, and so this whole business of having to deal with these Israelites wanting to leave, well, by his time, they were valuable slave power, but he had other problems on his mind, other issues he was dealing with, that his whole focus was not on this Israelite situation. So you see how, given those dates, that's how all that plays. And you can make a similar sort of case for the other dates, the dates of the 1466 and 1900. Okay? All right, well, let's go back to our story here. This new set of kings that we have that no longer knew Joseph and didn't care about him, how did that change things for the Israelites? Starting in verse 9. This new king who came into power said, "Look, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies and fight against us and leave our country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. So we've already seen that these Israelites multiplied greatly. They filled the land. They just were very prolific like rabbits. And that began to concern these Egyptians. And these new kings looked and said, man, we've got this huge group of people, of foreigners in our land. We've got to watch out. These guys could create a big problem. They could decide to take over Egypt and rebel against us. And there's so many of them that we would have a hard time defending ourselves. Or even worse yet, you know, we've got these Hittite problems or whatever other problems with enemies. They could side with those enemies and conquer us. So we've got to get them under control. So they did so by turning them into slaves. Okay, there is a valuable resource there with them. So they turned them into slaves, but they did so to try to limit them, limit their growth, limit their power, limit their strength. So how well did this plan work to weaken this growing mass of Israelites? Verse 12, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. So it was the harder that they beat them, the harder the harsher they treated the Israelites, the stronger the Israelites were and the more they expanded. So what did the Egyptians do? Verse 13, well, they worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the field. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. So you see a kind of a catch-22 kind of situation where the Egyptians treat the Israelites roughly and harshly to try to stop them from growing, stop them from expanding, weaken them, and instead it only makes them stronger and only makes them grow more, and that makes the Egyptians treat them even harsher, and just this continual cycle like this. So there you see it from the Egyptian point of view. What about from the Israelite point of view? How would you feel if you were one of the Israelites? You know, God, why are you doing this? What's going on? Did I do something wrong? You know, why were, from the Israelite point of view, why were they being treated like this? Were they being punished for something? Well, if you look at Psalm 105, verses 23 to 25, Psalm 105 is kind of a neat chapter. Take a look. It gives a good summary of a lot of the Old Testament stories here that we've looked at and we are looking at. Let's see again, verses 23 to 25. Then Israel entered Egypt. Jacob lived as an alien in the land of Ham. The Lord made his people very fruitful. He made them too numerous for their foes, whose hearts he turned to hate his people, to conspire against his servants. So why was this happening to the Israelites? Again, for the same purpose that God had sent them down there, to strengthen them, to build them up, to expand them, to turn them into a great nation. Verse 24, the Lord made his people very fruitful. And so that's what was happening. God was building and strengthening his chosen nation. He wasn't punishing them. In fact, that shouldn't have been a surprise to them. Way back in Genesis 15, in the early years of Abraham, God even told them this was going to happen. Genesis 15, 12 to 14, when God gives this blood covenant with Abraham, it says, and the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then Yahweh said to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. So this had all been foretold many, many years before, hundreds of years before, that they would be slaves for 400 years in another nation. And sure enough, that's what was happening to them here in fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. Why was it important that the Israelites endure hardship? It's one thing for them to go down to Egypt and expand and become a people, to become a great nation that God could then take into the promised land. But why was this hardship something that was an important part of God's plan? And why was it important that they, what part did that play? Well, chapter 3, verses 7 through 10 says, Yahweh said, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way of that the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, he's talking to Moses. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So why was it important? What part did this hardship play? Well, not only did God need to take them to the promised land, but they had to want to go. There had to be a reason for them to go, for them to things were nice for them. At the end of Genesis, they were in the best part of the land of Egypt. Everything was taken care of. It was a good life. So this hardship helped them long for a better place and helped them long for the promised land that God had promised to them. Okay, they longed for a release from this slavery. They longed for freedom that was awaiting them in the promised land. So there's a lot of analogies that we can draw between the Israelites and Christians and the experiences. You know, take a look at the whole aspect of slavery and freedom. What is Christianity? Is Christianity a life of freedom or a life of slavery? Well, actually, the answer is yes. The answer is both. Look at the Romans 6. What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? By no means. Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone to obey him as slaves, you're slaves to the one whom you obey, whether you're slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you wholeheartedly obeyed the form of teaching to which you were entrusted. You have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. So, we are free. We are free from being slaves to sin and the death that results from that. And instead, we are set free to become slaves of righteousness and the eternal life and salvation and greatness and blessings that come with that. Now, this whole hardship business, is that something that we should expect? I mean, you know, those who live in a relationship with God, God should protect us from those kind of things, right? Well, in Acts 14, verse 22, it says, we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God, they said. So these are Christians talking. The Christian life is not an easy life. Hardship does exist, just like it exists in other people's lives. In fact, though, as a Christian, you've got a big target painted on you, and Satan focuses and aims his arrows at you. He attacks us even more. He's got more work to do with us. And so he works on us even harder. So the life of a Christian is not one that's free from hardship. Now, there are some things that God can do through our hardship. Not that he brings the hardship to us. That's the result of living in a sinful and evil world and being sinful creatures. But God can take that hardship, God can take those difficulties and turn them to his good. In Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 through 11, it says, and you've forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves and punishes everyone he accepts as a son. So endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, well, then you're not legitimate children, and you're not true sons. Moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for that. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while, as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So one way to look at hardships and troubles that we have is that God could use that as discipline. God could be using that to show his love to us. God wants to take the experiences of our life and use them to shape us and mold us. The story of Joseph that we just finished looking at is a great example of that. God didn't cause any of those bad things to happen to him, but God certainly used those to shape and to mold Joseph to become who Joseph, who God planned Joseph to be, and so that Joseph could fulfill God's plan for his life. We'll see the same thing as we look at Moses' story. So God can take those hardships and use those as a loving father to guide and direct us. In Isaiah, we also see another way to look at discipline. Isaiah chapter 1, verses 25 to 26 says, I will turn my hand against you. I will thoroughly purge away your dross and remove all of your impurities. I will restore your judges as in days of old, your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward, you will be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Okay, just as when you take ore and throw it into the fire, it purifies and refines gold or whatever the mineral is that you're trying to get out of it. Likewise, the difficult times that we go through refine our faith. They purify our faith. They make our faith more pure and so that we grow in righteousness. Okay, the Romans 5 verse is a classic verse, one that would be great to memorize, or parts of it can be very meaningful as you're going through tough times. It says, not only so, but we also rejoice in our suffering because... rejoice in your suffering. Why would you want to do that? Well, because suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not disappoint us because God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit whom he's given us. So why might we rejoice in suffering? Or how can we look at the positive side of suffering? Because we know that suffering produces perseverance. And perseverance, as long as we continue to trust God, perseverance produces character. And character produces hope. And elsewhere it says hope does not disappoint us. Okay, because God is faithful to his promises. And then the other reference we have here is in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And Paul takes this even further as far as being happy and rejoicing in your sufferings. It says, starting verse 7, to keep me from being conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Well, therefore, I'll boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest in me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So another way to look at it is that when you are weak, our weaknesses, that opens the door. When we can no longer say that we're in charge of the situation, that we can no longer control things, when our weaknesses are exposed, that opens the door for the greatest power, Christ's power, God's power, to come in and take control. You take a look at the times of your life when your faith has grown the most. When has that been? During good times or bad times? It's been during the tough times. It's been when you could no longer handle things on your own and you're forced to turn to God. Okay? God forgive us for waiting until that time and not turning to him early. But as we turn control over to God, then his power takes control and takes charge, and we grow in faith. We see his power at work, and that builds us. We've looked at this verse numerous times before. We'll read it one more time. Something to remember as we undergo hardships and difficulties. Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Again, God does not cause bad things to happen to us, but God can take those bad things and turn them to his good. God does not guarantee that only good things are going to happen to his people, to Christians. Gosh, the Acts verse that we just read, we must go through many hardships before we enter the kingdom of God. That's what this life, we live in a sinful world, we have sinful lives, so we're going to experience hardship, we're going to experience difficulties and troubles and pain and suffering. But God can take those and work his good through those. So a key verse to remember, Romans 8:28. Okay, back to Exodus, verses 15 and 16. We've seen that they tried putting slave masters and oppressing the Israelites to try to keep them from growing, keep them from expanding, keep them from becoming stronger, but it just had the opposite result. So they go to plan B. What's plan B? The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. So Pharaoh went to the Hebrew midwives, the ones who were in charge of all the midwives, because there were too many just to have two of them, and said, okay, here's my edict. Whenever you deliver a baby, if it comes out and it's a boy, kill it. If it's a girl, you can let it live. So by killing all the boys, that kills the ones that could potentially fight against the Egyptians. So that's his plan. So how well does the plan work? Verse 17. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Well, then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? Well, the midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So we plan to do your to follow through with what you command us to do, Pharaoh, but by the time we get there, the only job for us is to clean up. The babies are born. Well, that was a very risky thing for the midwives to do or to say. If you lie to Pharaoh, if you oppose and disobey Pharaoh, what's the result? You can have your head. Your life can be very short. So this was a very bold and brave thing that they did. How did God respond to that? Verse 20, God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. In those days, for a woman to have children was a great blessing from God. And so God showed his blessing upon the midwives by allowing them to have children. And not only that, but the Israelites continued to expand and continued to grow. Okay? So Pharaoh had to come up with another plan. And that's the last verse of chapter 1, plan C. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Okay, every boy that's born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So it didn't matter if the midwife got there in time or not. If a boy was born, they were to throw it into the Nile. There it would drown, or the crocodiles would get it, something. But that would be a way he would take care of it. So that sets the stage and opens the story in chapter 2 for a special Hebrew baby boy to come to the scene. And we're told in numerous places that this was no ordinary child, and there's a number of reasons for that, one of which we see at the beginning of the story. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. So we have a couple of Levites. Okay? Who were Levites? Levites later on, we see a few decades later, are chosen by God to serve as the priests. Okay? The people who served him, all the tribe of Levi were to be priests and serve God, did the sacrifices and that. So both the husband and the wife were both Levites. Now the members of this family we see in Numbers 26, verse 59, says the name of Amram's wife, so Amram was the dad, was Jochebed, so Jochebed was the mom. She was a descendant of Levi, who was born to the Levites in Egypt. To Amram she bore Aaron, Moses, and their sister Miriam. So we see that Amram and Jochebed, by the way, if you look at the Exodus 6 verse 20 verse that you've got on your notes there, it says that Jochebed was Amram's father's sister. In other words, Amram married his aunt. Okay, so just as we saw Abraham marrying into the family, Isaac marrying into the family, Jacob marrying into the family, hundreds of years later, this is still going on among these Israelites. The three sons, or three children, Aaron, it appears, is the oldest, and then Miriam, and then Moses. Okay? Moses is the one that we're talking about here. Now, God had plans for this family, not just for Moses. Obviously, Moses is the one that God chooses and will and calls to set his people free. And we'll see that next week when we start getting into chapter 3 of Exodus. We also see that Aaron serves as a spokesman for Moses, because Moses says, I'm not able to speak very well. And so we see that in our story. We see in Micah 6, verse 4, that it wasn't just Moses that God called here. It says, I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. So Aaron and Miriam also served as leaders of the Israelites and helped with the leadership of this group, helped Moses. And then a special thing in Exodus chapter 28, starting in verse 1, says, Have Aaron your brother brought to you from among the Israelites, along with his sons Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, so that they may serve me as priests. Make sacred garments for your brother Aaron to give him dignity and honor. And it goes on and talks about that. And Aaron was the first great high priest, the first high priest. And the high priests were to come from Aaron's line. So Jochebed and Amram have this baby. Jochebed sees that he's a fine child and protects him, does not want him to die, hides him for 3 months, but eventually she's not able to hide him anymore. He's getting a little big. So what does she do? Verse 3. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. So she didn't just throw him into the Nile. She took a basket, she coated it with tar and pitch to make it waterproof and make it float, put the baby in there, and set it not in the Nile to go floating off, but in the Nile among the reeds to where it would just get caught there and stay there. And then Miriam kind of stood off from a distance to kind of watch to see what might happen here. So they were trusting God, didn't know what was going to happen here, but they trusted God for something to happen. And something happened. Now, a couple of notes here. The word basket that you see there, it's used one other time or in one other set of places. Throughout Genesis 6 through 9, we see that same word translated as the word ark when we're talking about Noah's ark. So we have the same sort of thing, saving this life from the waters that he would otherwise drown in. Again, they were bold to stand up against Pharaoh's edict and disobey Pharaoh in this. How were they able to do that? Well, Hebrews 11 says, By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So again, we see the faith in action. There's one other Hebrew baby that we know about that was saved from a royal command to kill Hebrew babies, okay, Hebrew boys. And who was that? Well, let's look at Matthew chapter 2. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, Out of Egypt I have called my son. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time that he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. By the way, Rachel died outside of Bethlehem, so that's what that reference is there, weeping for her children. So, who was saved from the king's slaughter, commanded slaughter of Hebrew boys? Jesus. Okay, the Nile under the king's edict was to be used to kill the baby boys, but instead the Nile is used to save Moses. Verse 5 of chapter 2. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Well, then his sister, that is the baby sister, asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman, Jochebed, took the baby and nursed him. So we see that Pharaoh's daughter runs across this baby and decides, "Hey, I want to keep him." But the baby's not weaned yet, so she hires a Hebrew girl, a Hebrew woman, who recently had a baby, to nurse him. And that just so happens to be the baby's mother, which she doesn't know. But so Jochebed nurses the baby and then turns the baby over after it's weaned to Pharaoh. And in verse 10, when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." So the Pharaoh's daughter named him Moses because she drew him out of the water. Moses in Hebrew means drawn out or to draw out. So you see that meaning there. But you know, Moses also has meaning in Egyptian. It means is born. You see this in some of the Pharaoh names, like Amos that we talked about earlier on page 2. Ah is born. There's Tutmos. Tut is born. There's Ra. Ra, who's the big sun god. Ramos, or Ramoses, okay, or Ramses is how we pronounce that in English. Okay, so Moses was a common part of a name, especially for pharaohs, because they usually had a name of a god. So and so is born, meaning is born in me, is born in, you know, Ra is born in Ramses, or is manifest in Ramses, or Ramses is basically God, is Ra on earth here, is kind of the way that those mean. Now, he was raised as an Egyptian. The next verse we see in verse 11 doesn't happen until about 40 years later. So we don't have a lot of story of him being raised, but there's a lot of meaning there, and there's a lot of purpose. Why would it be important, and what purpose might God have had for Moses being raised in Pharaoh's house? Well, Stephen explains this. If you look back at his speech in chapter 7 of Acts, starting at verse 20, he says, "At that time Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months he was cared for in his father's house. When he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him and brought him up as her own son." And then verse 22, "Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action." And you see, he was powerful in speech, even though he didn't feel that he was and needed his brother to be a spokesman. So what you see, though, is that during these 40 years, he spends 40 years in Pharaoh's household learning the Egyptian way of life. He spoke like an Egyptian. He spoke the language. That he was raised with the Egyptian language. He learned how a government worked. He learned how kings ruled. He learned the way of life in Egypt, medical things and government things, and basically God trained him to lead a group of people, to lead a nation during these 40 years. Okay. All right, so Moses was saved from the Nile. The Nile, actually this water led to him being found by Pharaoh's daughter and being saved. What other examples of water saving God's people do we have? Well, a number of them. One we looked at a few weeks ago in Genesis 7. Verse 7 says, "Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood." Okay, so Noah and his family entered the ark and they escaped and they were saved from the flood waters there. Exodus 14, we'll see that in a couple of weeks. This is when the Israelites are leaving Egypt, and Pharaoh's army decides, well, they want them back, and so they're pursuing him. Verse 21, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water to their right and on their left." And then they get across. In verse 27, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. So we see that the Israelites were saved from the Egyptians when they crossed the Red Sea. Okay, so you have water getting involved there. And then the other one that fits us, Mark 16:16, says, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. So the waters of baptism save us. We are saved through becoming children of God through that sacrament of initiation called baptism. All right. So now, verse 11, chapter 2 of Exodus. Moses is now 40 years old. And during this 40 years, he was raised as an Egyptian. So he now looks like an Egyptian, acts like an Egyptian, acts like Egyptian royalty. Does he realize, though, that he's not Egyptian? Does he realize that he's Hebrew? That these slaves that are out there doing this stuff, doing all this work and being beaten, does he realize that he's one of them? Well, verse 11. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went to watch where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. So you see this his own people comment a couple of times, so he realized that he was one of them. Well, glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. So he sees an Egyptian slave master just abusing one of the slaves, one of the Hebrews, and Moses stands up for him. Now, nobody sees him. He looks around. Nobody's around. So he kills the Egyptian and hides him in the sand, not thinking anything of it. Well, had anyone seen what he had done? Going on. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Well, later on we'll see God did, but are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Ooh, then Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. So someone saw me, someone found out, so it's now known that I've killed the Egyptian. Well, word eventually gets to Pharaoh. And what does Moses do? Verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. Okay, it's one thing for you to live in my house, me to raise you as an Egyptian, but I guess once a Hebrew, always a Hebrew. I shouldn't have trusted you. You can't go killing Egyptians, so he was going to execute Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Midian is over in the Sinai Peninsula, over on the other side of it. And who were the Midianites? Well, the easy answer is they were the descendants of Midian. Okay, but who was Midian? Well, Midian was one of the sons of Abraham, one of the sons of his second wife, Keturah. Okay, so these are Semites. These are descendants of Abraham. We'll see that they have the faith of Abraham. Okay, just because they were not descendants of Isaac doesn't mean that they did not believe and have faith in Yahweh. Okay. And it turns out that we'll see that who Moses meets up with happens to be the high priest of Midian. So he learns a lot about God and his relationship with God and leading God's people then. All right. So he ran away to Midian. And he sits down at a well. And what does he do at the well? And how does it lead to a home for him? Verse 16. Now, a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Well, some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, why have you returned so early today? They answered, well, an Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. Well, where is he? He asked his daughters. Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat. So he stands up and protects these seven sisters who are there to water their flocks, protects them from the evil shepherds. And the daughters go back and tell their dad, and he invites this Egyptian to come and be thanked and to eat with them. Okay, he's obviously traveling, a stranger, whatever. So, how does God bless Moses and Midian? Moses agreed to stay with the man. Heck, Moses didn't have anywhere else to go. He was looking for a home, and the man apparently had work for Moses to do, and we'll see that Moses became a shepherd for him. And the man gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." Okay, Gershom sounds like the Hebrew for an alien there. So he names his son to remind himself that he's an alien and a man without a home. So God blesses Moses in Midian, brings him in his household of this priest of Midian, and gives him a wife and a family and a job. And we'll see, as we talk about it next week, that he stays there for 40 years. Another 40. Now, we've seen some stories also where these wells are good meeting places for meeting women. You've got, in Genesis 24, is where Abraham's servant met Rebekah when he was looking for a wife for Isaac. It's also where Jacob met his future wife, Rachel, at a well. Okay. Okay, well, while Moses was in Midian, did Israel's problems get better? Verse 23, "During that long period, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God." So things continue to get worse, and Israel groaned in their slavery and cried out and longed for deliverance. Did God ignore Israel's cries? God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Now, remember that the Hebrew word remember does not imply that something was forgotten. Okay, God never forgot the Israelites. God, the word deals more so with bringing to mind. God brought to mind. From the Israelites' perspective, yeah, God forgot them. Okay, it looks like God forgot us. Why is he letting all this happen to us? God, listen to us. Where are you? But God didn't forget him. Okay? God was waiting for his time to be just right. And so now the time was right. God heard them. God brought his covenant to mind, was concerned about them. And we'll see in the next verse in chapter 3 that now's the time for him to do something about it. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the story that you've given us about Moses, about the Israelites, about how your plan, you have your plan so far out in the future that we cannot even imagine. For the Israelites, you brought them, you put things in place in Joseph's life, in Jacob's life, in Isaac's life, in Abraham's life, to get them to Egypt for this time of preparation. And all of these things happened in preparation for fulfilling your great plan through them, to bring them to your promised land, to make them the people that you intended them to be, through whom they can bless, you could bless them, they can bless other people, and through them all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Keep us mindful of that, because that's the same calling that you've given to us, that you promised to bless us so that we in turn can bless others, and through us all the nations of the earth can be blessed as we share your good news with other people. Thank you for those lessons through the stories that we see in your word. In Christ's name, amen.